Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, September the 6th, 1995. In the Creekside room this morning is Cedric Broughton, and he will be speaking on Palestine, Maccabees through Constantine. Let's listen in on Cedric Broughton.
Maccabees to Constantine. I don't know if we'll get all the way to Constantine, but we'll give it a go. If some of you were here yesterday, right, and you remember we kind of ended up with looking at Alexander the Great, and I put on the board some dates and names for you if in case you're interested in writing that down. I don't know if that's interesting to you or not, but history is not all dates, but occasionally dates are useful. Alexander the Great was, of course, the...
Your person.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Alexander the Great was, of course, the Greek general soldier who came and swept over and conquered much of the territory that we consider the Middle East. He defeated the Persians, and he died at a young age, early 30s. And when he died, his empire got divided up between a couple of his generals. And one was centered in Egypt, and one was centered in Syria, up in Damascus. Now, from 320 to 198, the one that was centered in Egypt was controlling the territory we know as Palestine. And from 320 to 198, there is, at least administratively, the Greeks are over the land of Palestine. And during that period, there began to be what they call the Hellenization of Palestine. Have you heard that term before? Mm-hmm. The Hellenization of Palestine. You know what that means? Anybody?
Greek.
Okay. Greek influence and Greek culture comes into Palestine. That involved the Greek language. Okay. Out of that, what I just talked about a few moments ago, there was a Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures, and that is called, do you know?
Septuagint.
Septuagint. Okay, that's the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures done down in Alexandria. Alexandria in Egypt was a city that in this period came to have as much as 20% population being Jewish. So it was quite a significant portion of the population was Jewish. So the Greek was Greek became to be the lingua franca of the people of Palestine, of Israel. They came to speak that, and even they had their scriptures in that language. Hebrew did not die out, of course, but Greek was being used in parts of the Jewish diaspora. By the time of Jesus, and I don't know, I'm not an expert in this, but Jesus spoke Aramaic, and so that language was also in Palestine and language of the common folk. The Greeks also created cities. Polis is the Greek term. They created cities, and in these cities they like to have things a Greek way. And what did that mean? What were characterized Greek cities?
Orderly.
Well, that could be. Yeah.
Temples.
Democratic. Okay. What kind of cultural structures did they build?
Forums.
Theaters.
Statues.
There became a gymnasium. You heard the term gymnasium, educational and athletic. The Greek games, the Olympics, that sort of thing. All of this kind of culture came to be influencing the Jewish people, not only in Alexandria, but in Palestine as well. And that's all what we call Hellenization of the land. In about 198, the generals up in Syria got powerful enough to defeat at least the generals in Egypt enough so that they had control of Palestine. So from 198 to 164, the generals from Syria had control. And these guys, this guy Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, you've probably heard of him, right? Epiphanes, the manifest one. What, anybody know what he did?
The abomination of the Olympic.
That's right. He is the guy looked upon by the Jewish people as really akin to, the devil himself because of what he did, the abomination of desolation. Antiochus actually didn't start out to be such a bad guy, but one of the things that happened to him is he got pressed by Rome. He got defeated in a battle with Rome. And Rome said, "We want money." And Antiochus said, "I don't have enough money to give to Rome. So where am I going to get money?" Well, the Jews were sitting there in Palestine, and he said, "That's a good source of money." And in Palestine, and in Jerusalem, there was a place where there was a whole bunch of money resting. You know where that was?
The temple.
The temple. Why was there a whole bunch of money resting in the temple? The Jews from all over the diaspora sent money to Jerusalem to the temple. They paid a temple tax.
When you're ready for it, give me a signal and I'll bring it right in. We can send that to the distributor right now.
Okay.
Do you need it right now?
No, not yet.
Just give me the signal.
Antiochus caused a consternation on the part of the Jews in Jerusalem and in Palestine, and there was an uprising from folks because of what Antiochus was doing. And in that uprising, then there was a lot of bad feelings, a lot of people being killed. And Antiochus said, "I'm going to emphasize the point. I am going to put a statue of Zeus on the altar area in the temple. And more than that, I'm going to go to the altar and I'm going to sacrifice pigs." Now, you see why the Jews weren't too happy with Antiochus, right? They weren't too happy with what he did. Antiochus's actions led to the rising up of somebody who started a dynasty. Now, let's read 1 Maccabees 1:41 to 64. That kind of describes what happened.
Now, tell me if you can't hear me.
Okay.
Then the king then issued a decree throughout his empire. His subjects were all to become one people and abandon their own laws and religion. The nations everywhere complied with the royal command, and many in Israel accepted the foreign worship, sacrificing to idols and profaning the Sabbath. Moreover, the king sent agents with written orders to Jerusalem and the towns of Judea. Ways and customs foreign to the country were to be introduced. Burnt offerings, sacrifices, and libations in the temple were forbidden. Sabbaths and feast days were to be profaned, the temple and its ministers to be defiled. Altars, idols, and sacred precincts were to be established. Swine and other unclean beasts to be offered in sacrifice. They must leave their sons uncircumcised. They must make themselves in every way abominable, unclean, and profane, and so forget the law and change all their statutes. The penalty for disobedience was death.
Okay, that's good enough. That is the Jewish record of that time. And that is in the book of Maccabees. And, of course, the Maccabees were a family that were headed at first. Maccabee, by the way, is not the family name. That's a term for one of the sons called the hammer. Maccabee means the hammer. There was an elderly priest 20 miles northwest of Jerusalem who refused to offer these pagan sacrifices. And he even went so far as to kill one of the Greek officials. That necessitated him, like Moses many years before, going off into hiding. And so he went with his five sons, and they became guerrilla fighters. Now, if you know anything about the land of Palestine, there's lots of hills and mountains and places to hide. David had done that way back when he was escaping from Saul. So they became guerrilla fighters. And they went around, they forcibly circumcised boys, they reestablished synagogues where they could, they threw down the pagan temples, they were making as much trouble for the Greeks as they could. One of his sons was named Judas Maccabee, the hammer. He was the third son. And in 164, he managed to defeat the Seleucid army at the city of Emmaus. And he occupied Jerusalem, and he cleansed the temple. Judas, the hammer, the back, he cleansed the temple in 164. Having done that, there was a period from 164 to 143 where even though he had had this great victory, things were still unsettled in the land, and there was back and forth who had control until about 143 when the last remaining brother who was alive, Simon, managed to finally drive out the Greek generals. You've heard of Hanukkah, right?
Yeah.
Hanukkah is the celebration of when Judas Maccabee was able to cleanse the temple. So that's where Hanukkah comes from. But interestingly enough, even though they cleansed the temple at that time, it didn't fully settle the issue until about 20 years later. If you have that Bible there, turn to 1 Maccabees 14, chapter 14. Simon was the one who was able to finally get a victory and consolidate the power of his family and of the Jews in the land. And in 1 Maccabees 14, there's kind of a celebration of his victory. Let's see, why don't you read verse 4 and verses 11 and 12.
As long as Simon lived, Judea was at peace. He promoted his people's welfare and lived happily all through the glorious days of his reign. And verse
11 and 12.
He restored peace to the land, and there were great rejoicings throughout Israel. Each man sat under his own vine and fig tree and had no one to fear. Those were days when every enemy vanished from the land and every hostile king was crushed. Simon gave his protection to the poor among the people. He paid close attention to the law and rid the country of lawless and wicked men. He gave new splendor to the temple and furnished it with the wealth of sacred vessels.
Does that sound like a praise of anybody else in the Bible? Simon managed to do what hadn't been done in hundreds and hundreds of years, and wasn't going to be done again for hundreds and hundreds of years. Here is a summation of that. Looking back over the 25 years, that's the 25 years between Judas and Simon's actions, we must ask ourselves why the Hasmoneans, that's the family, the Maccabean family, Hasmoneans succeeded as they did. Much of their success was undoubtedly due to the charisma of the Maccabean family itself. Their achievements in battle, the purification of the temple, and the fact that many family members had given their lives in defending the holy temple and the holy city accorded them a strong claim to leadership. They were able to consolidate large sectors of the Jewish population behind them. elders, rural and urban leaders, priests, Levites, and others all participated in Simon's coronation ceremony, so vividly described in 1 Maccabees 14. In addition, Hasmonean tenacity in pursuing their political goal despite all obstacles put them in a position to take advantage of any opportunities that might, and indeed did, present themselves. Finally, the Hasmoneans were blessed with good fortune on the international front. The mid-2nd century BC saw the decline of two major Hellenistic powers, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. The political vacuum in the region was quickly filled by petty ethnic kingdoms and independent city-states. Precisely at this time, the Hasmoneans, too, strove for political independence. They took full advantage of these circumstances to reach their end. Only once before in the history of Israel had a similar situation crystallized internationally in the 10th century BC, when David and Solomon carved out their far-flung and powerful kingdom. So, you have that golden era under David and Solomon, and then you have another golden era under the Hasmoneans, the Maccabeans, that occurred in the history of Israel. After the Romans came and took control over the land politically, it wasn't until when the Jews could have said that they had sovereignty over the land of Palestine. When's the next time? 1948. Okay. So just to kind of put these things in perspective and understand the history of the Jewish claim to that land in perspective, that's important. Well, after Simon took the hereditary titles of the high priest and the commander-in-chief and the ethnarch of the Jews. Simon brought together what even David didn't do, and that is he was not only the king of that, he didn't call himself king yet, that was left to later on, but he was king in all but name. He was also the high priest, and he was the commander-in-chief of the armies and that sort of thing. So he was all that put together, and he started the Hasmonean dynasty. Now, he had a son who reigned from 135 to 105. He had his name on coins even. And he expanded the territory a little bit. He captured Eden. Let's see. He captured, there's Jerusalem there. There's Jerusalem. He went all the way down and all the way up here, and he captured enough territory that almost matched David's kingdom, the son of Simon. He, in doing that, he took what was Eden, down here, around here, and he made those who were in Edom Jewish, made them get circumcised and made them convert to Judaism. Now, that's an important fact for one particular reason. You ever heard of Herod, Herod the Great? He was an Edomite. It was his forefather, his grandfather, I guess, that would have been forcibly made Jewish. Herod, although his official court biographer said that he really was from one of the families that had been exiled to Babylon and then came back in the time of the restoration under Cyrus the Great, that was the official court biography. But in fact, you know, Herod wasn't probably Jewish in his bloodlines, but he became Jewish as his family became Jewish because the takeover of their territory forcibly converted those who lived there to the religion of Judaism. So that's kind of an interesting fact.
What were they before they were circumcised? Were they considered Gentiles or what?
Yeah.
Just not practicing Jews?
No, they're Gentiles. They're not Jewish. They're Gentile. there is no there's really no distinction about non-practicing Jews. You're either Jewish or you're Gentile. There always have been a lot of Jews who weren't practicing religiously Jews, but they're still Jews.
But the Edomites were descendants of Abraham, weren't they?
Well, the theory is that those are the descendants of Jacob's brother, Esau. Okay. But they weren't really looked upon as Jews. Israel, remember Jacob took the name or was given the name Israel. The descendants of Jacob were the Israelites. So,
is there anything more involved in forcing a person to be Jewish than circumcision? That basically the rite of forcible conversion?
They probably... I don't know how to what extent they forced the Edomites to practice the religion of the Jews. I would expect that they required it to some extent.
They'd probably require a tithe too.
Tithes to the temple, temple tax, and that sort of thing. Yes.
What does BCE stand for on the board?
Well, secular historians use the reference BCE, before the Common Era, as a designation for the timeline. We use BC, you know, before Christ, AD Anno Domini, in the year of our Lord, but you can use either one. Now something else happened in this period from 135 to 105 that was important in understanding the history of the land in the time of Jesus. There came to be the development of several specific strains of parties, you might say, or sects, or denominations within Judaism. Do you know what they may be called? What are the famous ones that are mentioned in the Bible?
Pharisees and the Sadducees.
Pharisees and the Sadducees, okay. So Pharisees and the Sadducees come into existence as distinct groups in this period of time. So it's under the Hasmonean dynasty. So that's relatively recent. You know, this is by the time of Jesus, that's only 135, 150 years later that we have the events described in the Bible. So the start of the Pharisees were concerned with ritual purity, with interpreting the Torah, the oral tradition. The Sadducees were mainly concerned with what? You know?
Sadducees.
They were the temple folks. They were the temple folks. They were the priesthood. They were the ones who claimed, some say that the name Sadducees is a derivation of the name of Zadok, who was the high priest at the time of David, and that's where they took that name. Well, they were the priesthood, and they were, generally speaking, a broad generalization, pro-monarchy group. They were the ones who were most closest to the king and supporting the king. There was a third group that came into existence. We don't hear them mentioned by name in the Bible, but you've all heard of them because you've heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? And that group was the Essenes, okay? And so the Essenes were formed at this time, and they went out to the area we call Qumran and formed their own society, and we could do a whole series of classes just on them. But at any rate, this is where we have the beginning of those groups within Judaism.
What about the Zealots? They formed this time?
There were always guerrilla groups in Palestine that, depending upon the political circumstances, were more or less active. At this time, because there was, generally speaking, a good guy on the throne, a good Jew who would observe the rituals, who had driven out the Greeks and that sort of thing, there wasn't a need for a big guerrilla movement. in a few moments, I'll tell you. Later on, there was the zealots that we use in that term are really more the time of Jesus. You know, the end of after Herod the Great died until 70 A.D.
One other quick question.
Uh-huh.
Throughout all this time, the shifting of authority and control, where were the Canaanites in all of this, or the non-Jewish aboriginal inhabitants? What was their status, and were they at all...
There were always them living in the land. There were always those who weren't Jews living in the land of Palestine. We don't hear about them. Those are the poor folks. You know, those are the folks that are scratching out a living in the earth, and they go with the flow, whatever is convenient to make it through life. You know, make it through through the day. Also, of course, when the Greeks took control, there were persons related to that empire who were brought into the land of Palestine, who lived there. And likewise, when the Romans took control, there were persons. And in Jesus' day, you remember the talk about the Gerasene demoniac, you know? He went over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and there were those folks over there who were pig farmers. You know, they weren't Jewish. So there were always within the land folks who weren't Jewish. I've never seen statistics about how many were, at least at the time of Jesus, how many were non-Jews and how many were Jews in the land. I don't know what percentages there are, but they're always there.
So these foreign powers never... If they had to treat with the local folks, there was always this elite class that was Jewish. I mean, the indigenous people were never had any influence in events. It sounds like
the ones who had influence were those in Jerusalem, the Jews in Jerusalem, particularly those related to the temple. Remember the temple. When they came back from exile in Persia, in Babylon, they rebuilt a temple. Now, it wasn't anything like on the scale of Solomon's temple and anything like on the scale that the temple of Herod built. But there was a temple, and there was a priesthood, and there was an ongoing Jewish leadership core centered around the temple in all this period of time.
So this golden era, how long was that, from 164?
Okay, from the time of Simon taking control of 143 down to 63. So you see, that's less than 100 years. 63 is when the Roman general Pompey came in. Now, what had happened in this period of time is there had been some... family squabbles, and there was a little bit of who has power and who doesn't have power. And Pompey, in fact, came to have some influence because John Hyrcanus and his brother couldn't get along, and they went up to Syria to the Roman legate up there, and they said, you know, choose one of us. And so actually, Rome chose his brother first of all, and then quickly realized that wasn't the right person to bet on, and so they picked up on him. And so even though, you see, he's there in control from 63 to 40, Rome is really in control. Pompey has already taken control of, administratively taken control of the land of Palestine. And so the Romans are calling the shots on the big scale, but Hyrcanus still had the title of high priest. He still was the high priest. Now, after he died, there was a period of time when the land was not very settled. There was There were guerrilla fightings. There were bandits robbing people on the roads. It was a time of upset in the land. And there came to be a group, the Parthenians, from the east swept down even and took control of Jerusalem at one point there. And the Romans needed to reassert control over the land. And they chose a person to help them reassert control over the land, whose father had been been a kind of like a general. And that person's name is Herod the Great. Well, his name isn't the Great, but that's what we call him. His name was Herod. And what Herod did...
His name was the Great.
That's right. What Herod did is... Herod went to Rome. And he said to the emperor in Rome, he said, "Look, things are kind of in a bad way in this land, and you need somebody strong to be your local governor, your local king, your guy who's going to help control things and drive out the Parthenians and make this land stable once again so you can get your taxes and all that kind of stuff." And Caesar said, "Yeah, you're our man." And so Herod went back, and Herod was good. I mean, he wiped out those forces who were against him and against the Roman occupation of the land, and he managed to take control of Jerusalem and take control of the land. And you see what you see here is all Herod's territory that he finally controlled. He was under Rome, understand. He was the local king under Rome, but he was still king in the land nevertheless. He was crowned king in 37 BC, or BCE. So from 37 till when he died in 4 BC, Herod was the king. Now Herod is vilified pretty much in Scripture. he doesn't get a good name, and in fact, there's good reason for that. Herod wasn't such a nice guy at times. He murdered his wife and kids. He murdered other people who would cause any undermining of his authority and his power in the land. When Herod died, or just before he died, he had all the leaders of the Jews rounded up and taken, and he told his sister, they were taken over to his palace by Jericho, or to the Herodium, I forget which. But he told his sister, "Now when I die, I want you to kill all these people so that everybody in the land is going to be crying, because I know they're not going to cry for me." His sister, fortunately, didn't do that, but that shows how much Herod felt like he was hated in the land of Palestine. But the flip side of Herod is that Herod managed to accomplish a whole lot. And if you go to Israel today, a lot of what you see still standing is the result of what Herod did. Herod was a builder. He was a skilled diplomat, but he was a builder. He built shrines to Greek gods. He built the city of Caesarea, built a port there, made a port there and built the city of Caesarea. He built fortresses in Galilee and Perea and Judea and Jerusalem. The Herodium, Masada, you've heard of Masada. You may not have heard of Herodium, but Masada, Caesarea, a summer palace at Jericho, and of course the most famous thing that Herod built was the temple. Now, like I said, there was already a temple there, but Herod expanded the size of the temple quite dramatically, and began a building project on the temple that is variously dated about 20 or 19 BC. And that construction project he began wasn't really finished until about 64 AD. Unfortunately, then it was destroyed at 70 AD. I'll take the slides anytime now. As we think about this building project of Herod, he built a palace too, and he built a fortress called the Antonia Fortress, named after his first patron, Mark Anthony. You've heard of Mark Anthony? Mark Anthony got defeated by Octavian, who came to take the title of Augustus. Herod had thrown his weight with Mark Anthony. You remember Mark Anthony? Who was the famous woman he was involved with?
Cleopatra,
right. Well, after Mark Anthony got defeated in this big sea battle by Octavian, then Herod went to Octavian and he said, look, I was very loyal to Mark Anthony, and if you allow me to be king here and stay king, I'll be very loyal to you too. And Octavian said, sure. And in fact, Herod was very loyal to Octavian, to Augustus. So thank you very much.
I don't have a remote for this, so I'm going to sit here and tell you what slides when it's changed slides.
Well, I'll do it myself. Is this just thing you push down the back, right?
Push forward, right here in the back.
Okay, yeah.
Just turn the light on when you're ready.
Okay.
I can turn it on now if you want.
Yeah, why don't you do that, and I'll go through them.
Oh, sorry, I put the wrong way. It should be about right. You might have to move that back and forth.
Okay. Herod also built aqueducts. Thank you very much. Herod built aqueducts as well, and he built an aqueduct into the city of Jerusalem. He was a massive builder. Now, this, I'm going to show you a few slides. This particular slide is of a model that is in the hotel in one of the hotels in Jerusalem, on the grounds of one of the hotels. I forget the name of the hotel. But it is a model of what the city of Jerusalem looked like in the time of Christ. And actually, some of the what it shows is some of the building that took place even after Jesus was crucified. But you are looking up here, see up in the upper right-hand corner, that's the temple. And right below it, as you come down to the bottom of the screen from the temple, that area is the city of David. That area is what was David's city, okay? So you can see how small David's city was to what it became later on. But that is the Temple Mount, what's called the Temple Mount, up there in the upper right-hand corner. And the city is off to the left.
What are those little houses or something?
Those are houses and stuff. All this is made out of stone. It's an incredible model. I've never seen anything quite like this. This is, of course, what? You know what that is? That's the temple. That's the temple that Herod constructed, expanded upon and constructed. And you see in the foreground is...
That's a model.
Yeah, this is a model, of course. In the foreground is the wall of Jerusalem. On the other side of that is the area which would be Solomon's portico, they called it. It's where a lot of the discussion took place, where Jesus talked with people and disciples. Inside is... as you move in, you go to the court of the women, court of the men, and court of the priests, and inside the temple. Now, I don't know if you can tell, but see, there's a young woman. She's not young, but there's a woman standing at the very base of that wall. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
This gives you an idea of the size of the Temple Mount. Those stones that she's standing by, that's all from Herod's temple time. That's still standing. That's all from Herod's Temple Mount area, what they call the Temple Mount. She's standing under what they call Robinson's Arch, which some archaeologists believe was part of, I'm going to show you a map in a few minutes, part of how some people walked into the temple area was over this arch. But the size of that Temple Mount is just incredible. The size of those stones are just, you know, just amazing. Here's a closer-up shot of that. This is the western wall of the Temple Mount, also known as what?
Wailing
Wall. Okay. So you see up at the top, at the very top is the Dome of the Rock. When I was there, they were doing some reworking on the on that dome, and so that's what you see up there is a construction crane and stuff, but that's the Dome of the Rock. So that's the that is the Temple Mount wall from the time of Herod, from the time of Jesus. This is up in the where the clouds meet the ground there. That's the Mount of Olives, and where this man is sitting is. They have dug out the steps that date to the time of Jesus, time of Herod, the steps that led up into the temple area from the east side. And those are Roman columns that I'm standing next to. These steps are what they call the steps of the rabbi. And these were steps where rabbis taught their disciples. The interesting thing about these steps to me was that some scholars believe that this is where Jesus was teaching his disciples when Jesus was running down the Pharisees and the scribes, when he was saying, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites that you be." Remember that passage in Matthew? Well, right above the temple steps is where the offices of the scribes and Pharisees were. So Jesus was purposely running them down where they could hear it. Maybe Bill will talk about this when he talks about how Jesus got himself into trouble.
Leads to a gate.
No, that's the Golden Gate. It leads to another gate that's walled up. That those were gates on the east side, and this is the Golden, or the south side. I mean, the Golden Gate is on the east side. This is the Golden Gate. The Golden Gate. This gate is not as ancient as the other gates I was, as the Temple of the Stepi. This is from Suleiman the Magnificent's rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. The other one, where the Wailing Wall is and those steps of the Rabbi, that actually dates from the time of Jesus. But this is the place where the Golden Gate of Jesus' day was. And you see, of course, it was walled up by the Turks. And right below it is a Muslim cemetery. This is what they call the lithostratus. These pavement stones are from the courtyard of the Fortress Antonia. And this is the area where Jesus was brought when he was brought before Pilate. And they date him, the stones are striated because they needed to keep the horse's hooves from slipping on the stones. This area, of course, there's a church over it now, but there's a church over everything in Israel. But this is the what was a courtyard of the Fortress Antonia. This is what they say is it's under the area where, in the same area where the Fortress Antonia was, and it's what they call the King's Game that soldiers played, and they carved out how you do the game in the rock. And They say that this, remember when Jesus was mocked by the soldiers and the crown of thorns and the robe was put on and everything? Well, that was part of the king's game, they say. This is the Via Dolorosa. Of course, again, remember, because Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD, this is not the same Jerusalem exactly the way it was in Jesus' day, but it has a lot of similarities. The narrow streets, arches, all that sort of thing. The stones, you know, the stones that were knocked down were used to rebuild with. So that's going through. There is the Temple Mount, and that's the Dome of the Rock, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Remember, I was talking about the steps of the rabbi over here. And right here is where those offices of the Pharisees were and all that sort of thing. In Solomon's time, this is where Solomon's stables were. So that gives you a little bit of an idea. I'm going to show slides again Friday night. Some more slides than I'm showing now. Because I want to talk about the Crusades. The Dung Gate is on the left side of you. Okay? You can't see it from here. That is going down from the Mount of Olives to where you see the Dome of the Rock. So down to the Kedron Valley. That's the Kedron Valley between Mount of Olives and the Temple Mount area, the city of Jerusalem, the walled city. That's looking out to one of the churches, Domius Flevit. The place church commemorates, this church was built like a teardrop, and it commemorates where Jesus wept over Jerusalem. That church that has that mosaic on front is the Church of All Nations in the Garden of Gethsemane. That's the Garden of Gethsemane at the bottom of the Mount of Olives. That's an olive tree in the Garden of Gethsemane.
Is there any estimate as the age of that tree?
Well, what they say, the olive trees are a symbol of eternity in Judaism, because they say they don't ever really die. If they die, there's something, the roots or the seed of it or whatever continues on in life. So they don't date exactly to the time of Jesus, but they're pretty ancient. This is Masada, and this is one of the fortresses that that Herod the Great built, a place where if he needed to, his family could escape to hide. And of course, you remember what happened to Masada?
Yeah,
the suicide of 900 plus Jewish people. Yeah. This is the siege ramp, or part of the siege ramp that the Romans built to go up.
He lived there for 3 years, didn't he?
Herod?
To escape.
The Jews, the Zealots, lived there. Herod the Great, of course, was there from time to time, but he never really lived there. It was the Jews who were there, and they held out for, I forget how long, maybe it was 3 years.
But Herod had a palace there.
Yeah, he had a palace there. I mean, he went there, but he didn't live there continually.
Right. He had a bunch of palaces.
He jumped there for just in case.
Yeah, just in case. Okay. And there's another. You see the Dead Sea in the distance. See how close Masada is to the Dead Sea. This is on top. What's remaining is the lower portions of walls of storehouses and palace and that sort of thing. This is the Herodian. The Herodian is is another palace. It's southeast of Bethlehem, and it's a place that Herod had this mountain built, and he had a palace, I think, of 7 stories built in this mountain. And this is where he was supposedly buried, although the archaeologists have never found evidence of his burial there. But this is, they say, where he's buried. In the foreground, you see those pillars there? There was a huge swimming pool. I mean, huge swimming pool at the bottom of Herodion. And that's where Herod used to drown some of the people he didn't like. This is Caesarea on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. Caesarea, what you see there is the theater. Of course, some work has been done on it since they did an excavation. But this is the theater that was at Caesarea that Herod had built. It's where some believe Paul was brought before Felix and Agrippa. The walls you see in the background are Crusader walls. But there are also, if you see those little white specks of white, those are like Roman columns that are broken and fallen down and lying around. It was just incredible for me just to walk around there and see these Roman columns, you know, and just lying there. I had to get a shot of me on the stage, of course.
The central figure.
How do you Greek sympathize?
Grandest Roman of them all.
When was this incident at Masada on our schedule up here?
Okay, well, Masada took place. Let me run through where's the end. Masada took place in 73 AD is when it was finally taken by Romans. Qumran was destroyed in 68, 69 AD by Romans. What happened after the time of Herod, he had a son, Herod Antipas, okay? And Herod Antipas ruled for a long time. He ruled until 39 AD when Rome got ticked off at him and sent him off into exile in what is now France, and there he died. Then after that, there was a series of time when there was a lot of turmoil in the land of Palestine. There was also turmoil in Rome, you might remember. You've heard of Caligula, and there was a whole series of events in Rome where who's in charge was open to question too. But in this period of time, the zealots chose this opportunity to try to revolt against Rome. And Rome finally had enough wherewithal to get it together, to come down and take control. And of course, Rome, there's a lot of infighting between the Jews too. If you read, you ought to pick up a easy reading copy of Josephus. I mean, there are condensed versions of Josephus and Josephus in easy to read language and stuff like that. But Josephus describes all this. But there was this warfare between various factions in the Jewish group, and in part that helped to bring about their defeat because they didn't have a united front against the Romans. But the Romans came in and besieged Jerusalem. Vespasian was the original besieger, and then he got called back to Rome to be the Caesar, the Augustus, and his son Titus finally is the one who was able to defeat the Jews and go into Jerusalem, and Jerusalem was destroyed. It was burned. It was stoned. Remember, Jesus had the prophecies recorded of Jesus. Now, well, I won't get into that. But Jesus said, no stone would be left on another. And that was almost literally true. Of course, the parts of the Temple Mount, Citadel, were still standing from the time of Herod and time of Jesus, but most of the city was destroyed, wiped out. And this magnificent temple that was only been completed 6 years before, you know, Jesus said, "Don't invest your livelihood, your energy, your life into things of this world, because it's gonna be gone one day." Well, there it was. So it's an incredible story. We'll pick up Friday night with from here and go on and talk about what happened since then. Thank you. Last year. I didn't get as far as I meant to get.